5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Merkle Media.
Good, everybody. This is Joel Thomas, and this is Free the Rabbits. And how are all the free range rabbits doing out there today? First off, I want to say thank you to everyone who's been giving a 5-star review. It has really helped the show grow because it allows the show to get deeper into the algorithm so people that don't normally get a hold of the show can get a hold of the show. So, in saying that, if you've been listening to the show and you haven't given a 5-star review, please go do that now before we even get started. And if you're new to the show, well, listen to the show first. And if you feel like it deserves a 5-star review, please give it a 5-star review at the end of the show. Also, for people who have been asking how they can donate to the show, well, there's a couple of ways. First, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/freetherabbits. You can give a one-time donation there, or you can set yourself up for a monthly donation. Also, you can go to YouTube, where we have YouTube memberships. We have 3 different tiers. We have Nephilim Portal Baby, Nephilim Hunter, and Good Nephilim. All 3 of those have a few different options, but they all come with custom emojis that you can use in the comments and use in the live chats. Again, I really appreciate you guys helping the show grow in any way that you can, even if it's just donating your time. And now, let's get into the show. What's up, guys? I'm glad to be back with you this week with another episode of Free the Rabbits. I'm excited about this one. I've talked about this subject before, but I've never done it in this amount of in-depth research. And I'm excited to explore some other ideas that go along with it. And as a matter of fact, I've had several people who listen to the show ask me, when are you going to talk about all the crazy technology and alchemy that surround the David and Goliath story? And I told them a long while back that eventually I would get to it. And here we are. And I'm excited to do it here on this show, because I can really expound on some of the ideas I talked about a couple years ago, and I can really go into depth with some of the strange things that surround the David and Goliath story, not only about Goliath and him coming from Nephilim origin and his armor and weaponry having some sort of special technology or quote-unquote alchemical magic attached to it, but also Saul having armor that has Nephilim alchemical magic attached to it too. And if you'll remember, I did an entire episode on King Saul coming from Nephilim origins himself, and that would be where we get the idea that his armor also had some sort of Nephilim technology attached to it. But we'll go into depth with that today. And we'll also talk about the stones that David retrieved from the brook and killed Goliath with, and how that there was a alchemical process involved with that, that those stones were transmuted into something greater by the time that they connected with Goliath. So to get things rolling today, we're going to go into who Goliath was, because that's going to be very important for the setup for when David comes along. Because at this point in time, Saul is still the king. David is a shepherd boy. This was the catalyst that started David's ascent into the kingship. So we'll start with 1 Samuel 17. And there went out a champion out of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath, whose height was of 6 cubits in a span. That's verse 4. Verse 5, and he had a helmet of brass upon his head. He was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of brass. And he had greaves of brass upon his legs and a target of brass between his shoulders. And the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spearhead weighed 600 shekels of iron, and one bearing a shield went before him. So we're going to break down these verses. We're going to talk about Goliath's height. We're going to talk about his armor weight. We're also going to talk about the Midrash today a lot. I'm going to explain to you what that is, why that's important. When we look at some of these texts, these were exegeses of the text by rabbis in the past. And I'm not saying that we take everything they say as verbatim, but it's important to look at historical figures who did very deep dives into the Hebrew of the text to understand what was going on around said text. So if we take a cubit to be approximately 18 inches in a span to equal 6, this figures to a height of approximately 9 feet 6 inches. So that's according to the Masoretic text in Hebrew, and that's what the 6 cubits in a span would roughly be. 9 feet 6 inches, almost 10 feet. And that could vary, right? But that's what we have deciphered from the text what it could be. Now, Goliath also donned a smorgasbord of military equipment. His greaves were a type of leg armor. They were worn by Angian cultures. His helmet was like that of Assyrians. His scale armor was akin to Egyptian armor, and his sword was likely similar to an Eastern scimitar. So it's like he had all these different styles, which would make sense if he was from Nephilim origin and he came from the gods. You're talking about all these other cultures who worship the gods, worship Nephilim. He would be, have been considered a god in his own right. So his helmet would have probably weighed around 30 pounds. Again, this is just estimation. I'm going to show you in the Midrash where they think that his armor weighed a lot more than that. Now, 30 pounds would be like putting a 30-pound weight on top of your head. Just imagine that. 30 pounds you just laid on your head. Imagine if you put a t-shirt on that weighed 150 pounds. That's what his bronze-scaled coat of mail would have weighed in at 5,000 shekels. That'd be like strapping a small person to your chest and running around. And the greaves were made of bronze. That would be like soccer shins for people that don't understand what greaves are. And you'll see those in a lot of Roman shows and Greek shows about Greek mythology and just ancient times in general. You'll see this with armor a lot. And imagine the weight that those had to be, and imagine running around with those on your legs. The iron tip, or this weaver's beam, would have weighed about 30 pounds as well. So that's just the spear ahead would have weighed about 30 pounds, and that's in addition to the rest of it. So everything he had weighed a lot, right? Now, to get a little bit deeper into what some of this stuff could have weighed, we're going to look at the Midrash. Now, the Midrash is an expansive Jewish biblical exegesis. It uses a rabbinic mode of interpretation prominent in the Talmud. The word itself means textual interpretation, study, or exegesis, derived from the root verb derish, that's in Hebrew, which means to resort to, seek with care, inquire, require. So it means to literally take the text down to the nth degree and back so you can give it a broader meaning than just what it is. And this goes to what I always say about research in general, that I can read and study the exact same thing you can, and I can determine a different idea. And I think that's very, very, very hard for people to understand in this day and age of social media, especially when it comes to conspiracy theories. People think they have it all figured out with everything. They think they can never be wrong once they figured out a certain thing. And they believe that the people they listen to are right, and other people that they don't like what they have to say are wrong. And they think that those people need to dig deeper. You'll hear it all the time in this community. You need to go dig deeper. Dig deeper, you young whippersnapper. Yeah, you're not old enough. Dig deeper. And I laugh at that. Well, one, because I'm 43 years old, and I've heard that from people in the community before. I don't think they know how old I am. But I'm not saying that I'm some master of knowledge by any stretch. What I am trying to say is that I go into this, any kind of research that I do, knowing that whatever I determine could end up being wrong. And I'm always open to being wrong about things. I just don't think that most people are like that. And I think that it takes a lot of bearing the ego, to borrow a Gnostic term, even though I'm not a Gnostic by any stretch of the imagination, but it does. It takes you being able to understand that you could be wrong. And just to throw it back to an older episode that I've done about the Mandela effect, I probably got the most backlash on that episode than any episode I've ever done. And people were super up in arms because I had a different idea. And what were the common things that were said? Dig deeper. You need to do more research. You're gaslighting me, which I thought was hilarious because the terminology for gaslighting is not me having a different opinion than you. That's just me having a different opinion. And I think that we have to do better. But to get to the Midrash, this is what these guys were doing. Essentially, they were taking the text, they were studying it, and they were trying to determine what was the deeper context of it. And again, I think that we should constantly do that with any research that we do. And I'm here to tell you, I don't have it all figured out. And my opinion is my opinion, but I want to encourage people this. One thing I'll never do is tell someone they're stupid or they're unread or they're not good researchers. Now, some of that could be true. You know what I mean? Sometimes people just fly off and say whatever, they believe whatever because they just heard somebody say something or they saw a news article headline, right? But let's just say that two people are researching the same thing and they do the same amount of research on it. They can literally come away with two different viewpoints. And I think that's so tough for people to understand. Why don't you see what I see? Because I don't. I have a different perspective. And some of that happens because of our own personal experiences in life, how we grow up, the interactions we have with people. If you have someone who's more secluded, who doesn't have a lot of friends, who lives in turmoil, would probably have a different perspective than someone that's on the completely opposite side of the coin. And then again, there's all kinds of machinations in between. Those are just the two extreme ends of the spectrum with people. So as we look at the Midrash and what these rabbis are saying, this is very much that type of idea. They are taking the text, they're studying the text deeply, and then they are coming up with what they believe is going on around the text. And that's not just from reading the Bible or the Torah in this case. That's also from reading other writings that were going on around the same time to decipher the context of what's going on around what is written. So in the Midrash, it talks about Goliath boasted of having slain the two sons of Eli. He captured the Holy Ark of the Covenant, brought it to the house of Dagon, where it stayed for 7 months. And I'm going to read the context of that, because what happens to the statue of the god Dagon was a precursor to what happened to Goliath later on. And he also talked of having led the van of the Philistines in every war, scattering the enemy before him like dust. Notwithstanding all these valorous deeds, he had not been found worthy to be the captain over 1,000. So he was considered this Nephilim general to some regard. Now, he also had brothers, and we'll talk about that in a little bit too, because people always talk about the five stones of David, and that one was meant for Goliath and the other four were meant for his brothers. I want to get into that and say that while it is possible, it's not definitive. And I'll show you how it's not definitive biblically, that we have to even look to the Midrash to even get that idea, so where we know that it's actually just four. So we'll get into that, and then it's left to up to your determination on what you think about it. I will say this. Some preachers are out there preaching that the reason why David got five stones is because Goliath had four other brothers and accounted for five, because if he truly trusted God, he would have only picked up one stone. So he had to pick up four more to cover his brothers in case they showed up, because that's supposedly the faith of David. I don't believe that at all. I'm going to show you specifically why that the reason why he picked up five stones. One, God told him to do it. So he just did what God told him to do regardless. It wasn't on his own. This is what God impressed upon him to do. And the five wasn't necessarily indicative of Goliath and his four brothers, as it was more of the grace of the Holy Spirit. And we'll get into that a little bit too. But we're going to get into 1 Samuel 5, and we're going to talk about the ark, because this is where we get the idea that Goliath in the Midrash helped take the ark and brought it to the house of Dagon. Verse 1, after the Philistines had captured the Ark of God, they took it from Ebenezer to Ashdod, carried it into the temple of Dagon, and set it beside his statue. When the people of Ashdod got up early the next morning, there was Dagon fallen on his face before the Ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and returned him to his place. But when they got up early the next morning, there was Dagon fallen on his face before the Ark of the Lord, with his head and his hands broken off and lying on the threshold. Only the torso remained. That is why to this day, the priests of Dagon and all who enter the temple of Dagon and Ashdod do not step on the threshold. So that just caused a lot of turmoil. They ended up returning the ark back to the Israelites. But according to the Midrash, Goliath was one of the key figures that helped take the ark from the Israelites. And if that's the case, then it makes sense. He's a Nephilim. Of course, he would try to steal this ark technology that the Israelites had that was from Yahweh. And that was important to these Nephilim who came from these fallen entities, specifically Dagon. And I believe that Dagon, who was a god worshipped in ancient Syria across the middle of the Euphrates, with primary temples located in Tuttle, Terica, though many ascitations of his cult come from cities such as Mari and Emar as well. in settlements situated in the Upper Euphrates area, he was regarded as the father of gods, similar to the Mesopotamian Enlil, as well as the lord of the land, god of prosperity, and a source of royal legitimacy. So he was considered the father of gods. And there's no known text of any parentage of Dagon. So Dagon is said to be a creator in his own right. And again, he's attached to Enlil, who was also father of the gods. And he was an archetypal father of the gods and a creative figure, which we just talked about. So he's considered the lord of the offspring, the lord of Nephilim, the lord of other gods, other Elohim. I would consider Dagon to be one of those top tier Elohim that left the divine council, and that he probably was a father to a lot of different Nephilim, possibly even Goliath himself. And I know some people want to say that Goliath was some sort of more watered down version of Nephilim, which he very well could have been. And I'll explain where he could have been that, or he could have been directly from some sort of fallen entity, because we do not know who Goliath's father was. However, in the Midrash, which we will talk about a little bit later, we do know who his mother was. Now, one of Dagon's best documented functions was guaranteeing abundant harvest of grain. However, he's not an agricultural god at all. He's the source of prosperity in general. So this guy was a big time god. And the fact that they put the Ark of the Covenant in there with this idol, this graven image of Dagon, and the fact that overnight, on the second overnight, that the head was knocked off and the hands were also knocked off as well. So that was definitely a divine movement from Yahweh, from God of the Israelites, to show that he is the creator, the God, not the demiurge. I won't go there again, but I promise I will always go against the Gnostic viewpoint that Yahweh's evil. So we're going to get into Goliath when he shows up to the Israelites to do battle with them, with the Philistines. He basically starts calling them out and saying that he is going to single-handedly take over the Israelites. Bring your top warrior. Bring your best. Whoever wins this battle. And in the Midrash, he asked, but what had Saul done? Why had he been made king? If he was a man and warrior, he should now come forward to meet him. But if he was a weakling, let Israel choose another champion. So I find that interesting too, because we did an entire episode about Saul coming from Nephilim origin. And it seems like that was a straight shot at Saul for being of Nephilim origin and not coming out to meet another Nephilim on the battlefield. Now, this gets into that good Nephilim territory. And side note, I am working on part four of that. I've got some really cool stuff I'm going to introduce in part four, specifically Saul's son as a part of that. But we have to talk about Saul's Nephilim bloodline and the fact that Goliath's challenging that on the battlefield. If we look in that deeper context of that, it's even crazier, because this is what the Israelites wanted. They wanted a Nephilim king, because all the rest of these countries around these nations had one. They wanted somebody tall, huge, to represent what they saw everyone else had. They didn't want what God wanted for him. So Goliath was permitted to repeat his defiances for 40 days. And I'll explain when we get into his mother, why that's also significant with the 40 days. And according to the Midrash by a Rabbi Hananah, he said that his armor weighed 60 tons. But then there was another rabbi, Abba Bar Kahana, and he stated that the armor was 120 tons. So again, this is back to two people looking at the same information and coming with two different ideas, regardless if it was 60 tons, 120 tons, or less, which I was talking about earlier. It's a lot. This guy was huge, and the weaponry that he had was spectacular. And I'm even going to talk about today how I think it was alchemical and quote unquote magical as well, or some sort of what we consider magical, right? It was some sort of technology, this Nephilim technology. So now we're going to get deep into the story, right? We're going to get into the lore. We're going to get into the part where David meets Goliath. But to get that, we have to get to what Goliath was doing and saying. So 1 Samuel 17:8, and he stood and cried unto the armies of Israel and said unto them, why are ye come out to set your battle in array? Am I not a Philistine, and ye servants to Saul? Choose you a man for you, and let him come down to me. If he be able to fight with me and to kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then shall you be our servants and serve us. And the Philistine said, I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. So Saul and the Israelites hear this. They're scared, which I find fascinating that Saul is scared. Was Saul scared because he thought he would lose to another Nephilim, that he would be exposed as not being as strong as what he looked to be? I don't know. I think it's an interesting connection there if we really hone in on the fact that Saul himself was of Nephilim origin. And again, I encourage people to go back and listen to that episode because I break that down thoroughly on how that works. So during this period of time, David's father, Jesse, gives corn and loaves of bread and tells him to run to the camp of his brethren, right? And he takes cheese, he takes food down there. At this point, he hears about Goliath. And we're going to jump to verse 24 now. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were sore afraid. And the men of Israel said, have you seen this man that has come up? Surely to defy Israel is he come up, and it shall be that the man who killeth them, the king will enrich him with great riches, and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. And David spake to the men that stood by him, saying, what shall be done to the man that killeth this Philistine and taken away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? The people answered him after this manner, saying, so shall it be done to the man that killeth him. So everything that they said, the king will enrich him, give him his daughter, make his father's house free in Israel. All these things, he will be elevated to upper status in Israel. So at this point, David decides to do it. He said, I'm going to do it. You know, his brothers tell him, no, what are you thinking? You're a small shepherd boy. He's being told over and over not to do it, but David pushes to do it anyway. So at this point, he meets with Saul. And Saul is going to give David his own armor. Now, I know I've talked about this before, and I went into some detail of this in the story of King Saul being a Nephilim, but we'll definitely go into it a little deeper today. So in verse 38, and Saul armed David with his armor, and he put an helmet of brass upon his head, also armed him with a coat of mail. That was KJV. I'm going to go to the Berean. Then Saul clothed David in his own tunic, put a bronze helmet on his head, and dressed him in armor. Verse 39, KJV, and David girded his sword upon his armor, and he essayed to go, for he had not proved it. It's very important, proved, and when I read the Berean, it'll be a little bit different translation, but they'll give you a really good context between the two words, so proved it. And David said unto Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not proved them. David put them off him. In the Berean Standard, verse 39, David strapped his sword over the tunic and tried to walk, but he was not accustomed to them. I cannot walk in these, David said to Saul. I'm not accustomed to them. So David took them off. Now, we're going to break down with his armor what that means in Hebrew. It's madal. And we look at the root Hebrew word of that is mada. It means knowledge or thought. It also means knowledge, thought, and science. And when you really break that down, then you start understanding that, oh, wait a minute, what is this armor? And David's saying that he's not accustomed to it. He hasn't proved it. It never said it didn't fit. I think that's a big discrepancy that people don't understand. And I grew up my whole life thinking that David was this little shepherd boy. And of course, King Saul, this big king, giant king, literally, and the more I started digging into it, gives him this armor to put on. And David looks at it. I can't go out in this. I can't move. It's too big. That's not the case. It's just saying he hadn't proved it. He's not accustomed to it. It never said it didn't fit. And I'm going to go a little bit deeper with why I think that the armor did fit. Now, you may ask, well, if he was a young shepherd boy, how did the armor fit if he just put on a large man's armor, a Nephilim giant king's armor? How would it fit? Well, to do that, we have to go to the Midrash again, and we have to go to a rabbi called Shlomo Yitzhaki, or Rashi, which I'll refer to the rest of this episode as Rashi, because that's what most people know him as. And he was a French rabbi who authored the comprehensive commentaries on the Talmud and Hebrew Bible. He is commonly known as Rashi. And he was born in 1040, and then he passed away on 1105. He lived for 65 years, and it was said that he was a descendant of King David himself. So he would have been super invested to dig up all kinds of writings, commentaries, writing his own commentaries on any type of story of King David, because he was, according to what is said of him, that he was from the lineage of King David as well. So in the commentary, the exegesis that Rashi wrote about these specific verses, and I'm going to read the verse, and then I'm going to read the commentary that he wrote too. David girded his sword over his garment, then he tried to walk, but he was not used to it. David said to Saul, I cannot walk in these, for I'm not used to them. So David took them off. Now, the writings that Rashi wrote, David in his own battle garments, they changed and became David's size. Since he had been anointed with the anointing oil, although they belonged to Saul, who was taller than all the other people from his shoulder upward. And when Saul noted this, he cast an envious glance toward him, and David realized it. So the armor, this giant Nephilim armor, which was probably Nephilim tech of some sort, probably some sort of what we would consider magical armor, that when he gave it to David, because I think Saul did it as a way to show David that, listen, you can't go out there. Put on this armor. You're going to need something. Put on my armor. It's the best armor. But the fact that David, who had already been anointed with anointing oil, puts on this giant Nephilim armor, it fits. According to Rabbi Rashi, according to the Midrash, these exegesis of the text, the armor fit him perfectly. Now, you may ask, what's the significance of that, Joel? What does it mean? Well, two things. One, it was proof that David was blessed and was fit to be king. We don't know where the armor came from. The armor could have been holy for all we know. It could have came from a good source. Doesn't mean that it wasn't Nephilim technology or some sort of advanced technology. And it could have come from a negative source. It wasn't like Saul wasn't flubbing up left and right at this point. So the fact that David put on the armor and it fit made Saul jealous, because Saul saw what Samuel had pretty much already told him in prophetic visions, that there was another that would come and take his place. And he's seeing this small shepherd boy put on his Nephilim armor, and it fits perfectly. Now, the other thing, David saw that Saul was looking at him enviously. He knew that. But also, he trusted God. And he said, no, my Lord, take your garb, for I cannot go with these. Now, think about this. You put on Nephilim armor to go to battle with another Nephilim. That seems like the logical thing to do, especially if you're not a warrior. I want to put on this magical armor. Oh, it fits? Yeah, let me go out there. I got a chance. The fact that he turned it down and it fit is way more significant to me than if it didn't. Because if it didn't fit, well, I can't wear this. It doesn't fit. I'm not going to wear this. No, he turned down Nephilim technology, in my opinion, to roll with Yahweh, roll with God. because he trusted that God would give him the insight to take down Goliath. And the fact that he turned it down in front of Saul too, two things. Had to burn Saul up a little bit because of the confidence that David had, but also there's probably a part of him that hoped that he was going to die too. Well, you didn't take my armor, so now you're going to die. Well, we know that's not true. We're going to get into the next part when we get into the stones.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
So verse 40, and he took his staff in his hand and chose him five smooth stones out of the brook and put them in a shepherd's bag, which he had even in a scrip, and his sling was in his hand and he drew near to the Philistine. So in this verse, the Hebrew word for stone is obanim, and there are 41 occurrences of it, and it literally means just stone. That's it. I've got some pretty extensive Hebrew dictionaries, and you look up obanim and it's like a small sentence. It just says stone. That's it. It's very significant, though. So before we jump into what I think could have happened with the stone before it hit Goliath, I want to talk about the brothers, because it's a huge point of contention with people. And I don't want to say that there's no validity to it, but I also want to say I don't think that we need to take on board the fact that David had to get the five stones because Goliath had four other brothers, that that's the reason he did it. I don't think that's the reason he did it. Also, we have no idea if that's the only brothers that Goliath had one. Now, again, we go to the Midrash. There is a portion I will read to you that does suggest that he did have four other brothers. So there is that part we can align up, but there's nothing biblically, I want to state that, nothing in the Bible that states that Goliath had four other brothers. Now, we look at the context and we can derive that there were four other giants in the scripture, and they seem to come from the same giant. This is where the idea comes from. This is where, again, you'll see preachers up there preaching and saying this is a fact. I won't go as far as saying it's a fact. Now, is there a lot of circumstantial evidence that points to it? Absolutely. But I also don't think that's the only reason that he got four other stones. And I don't think that because he got four other stones that the giants had to be there. These four other giants had to be there because if not, oh, he didn't have enough faith that only one would take Goliath out. No. One, he would have got five stones because God told him to do it. Just think about it that way. And I'll show you why that's significant, this number five. So in 2 Samuel 21, we're told that Goliath had at least one other brother. However, the entire chapter seems to indicate that it is about the four brothers. And I'm going to read these scriptures and you'll get the idea of where this comes from. 2 Samuel 21:16, and Ishbi-Benob, which was of the sons of the giant, the weight of whose spear weighed 300 shekels of brass in weight, he being girded with a new sword, thought to have slain David. And in the Berean, then Ishbi-Benob, a descendant of Rapha, and we can go into the Hebrew and break down what Rapha means, ghosts, shades, spirits. Also, the Rephaim, which is the derivative off of that, stands for giants, whose bronze spear weighed 300 shekels, and he was bearing a new sword resolved to kill David. And I just wanted to read the Berean in there because of the descendant of Rapha. I like that nod to the Rephaim. So there's one supposed brother, right? Again, it just says of the giant. Was there only one giant? We know there was tons of giants. So what giant are we talking about? It seems to be, though, that this is the same giant these guys are coming from. This is, again, where we get the idea from, but there's no definitive verse that says this was Goliath's brother. That giant was also Goliath's father. We don't have that. It's just supposition that theologians and preachers have come to. But again, it's definitely, the correlations are there. I'm not going to take that away from people who think that this is the case. It could very well be. We got another brother here, 2 Samuel 21:19, and there was again a battle in Gob with the Philistines, where Elanon, the son of Jeroboam, a Bethlehemite, slew the brother of Goliath, the Gittite, the staff of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. So in this particular one, yes, we finally get the brother of Goliath, the Gittite. So we do have this verse here where we know that this was a brother of Goliath. And this is where it's like, oh, well, these other ones have to be his brother too. So it could be. And I think that we can lean towards it, especially when I get to the Midrash and say that, okay, it's possible that these are also the brothers. 2 Samuel 21:20, and there was also a battle at Gath where there was a man of great stature with six fingers on each hand and six toes on each foot, 24 in all. He too was descended from Rapha. And that's in the Berean. And this is one we don't have a name for. But this is the verse that signifies that the Nephilim had six fingers and six toes. And this is where we get that from, that one verse in the Bible. But again, no name. We have to go to 1 Chronicles 24 to get the other supposed brother. And it came to pass after this that there arose a war at Gezer with the Philistines, at which time Sibekai the Heshethite slew Sippai, that was of the children of the giant, and they were subdued. So again, we have to really stretch out and say that this one giant was the father of all five of them. That's counting Goliath, to say that they all fit within there. But again, we'll get to the Midrash here in a minute, and then we'll show why people think that. And again, to begin with, the primary text in 1 Samuel 17 does not mention Goliath having any brothers. The focus is entirely on Goliath, his interactions with Saul and the Israelites, and then David showing up to conquer him. But again, we do know of one specific brother that's said to be his brother. So that's where we get that particular idea from. And it said that they were descended of the Anakim. And we know of the Anakim from Numbers 13:33, which I talk about a lot. We even saw the Nephilim there, the descendants of Anak that come from the Nephilim. We seem like grasshoppers in our own sight, and we must have seen the same to them. And this is, I've talked about this a million times, but it's a very important story with the 12 spies that go into Canaan, and 10 of them come out and tell Moses that exactly what I just read you. They're freaked out. They just saw a bunch of tall giants, these Nephilim, these sons of Anak, the Anakim. And Deuteronomy 2:10-11, the Emims, which are giants too, dwelt therein in times past, the people great and many and tall as the Anakims. They were also regarded as giants like the Anakim, but the Moabites called them Emim. So we know of several different types of giants throughout the Bible. And Goliath and his brothers represent the forces of chaos in opposition to God's purpose. So it's not just that these giants existed, which I believe they did in real life. I believe the story is real, but it's also an allegory as well that shows us how to conquer our own giants, conquer the chaos with God's purpose. It's a very important part of the story. That's what we pull from it. Yeah, the Nephilim stuff's fun, and digging into all of ancient history's fun, but how do you make it applicable to your life? That's one thing that I encourage on the show all the time with you guys. Anything that I teach on the show or talk about on the show, I hope you can find something to make it applicable to your own lives so you don't live in darkness. You know, another thing I'm really tired of hearing, specifically Christian conspiratorial people, not all, but there's a contingent of them so obsessed with being in the darkest timeline. We're in the darkest timeline. We're going to die. We're in the worst part. We're at the end. Oh, Jesus, take me home. I'm ready to go home. You mean home here on earth? Because that's what he created for us, not heaven. I just want to make that clear. I've said that plenty of times. When are we going to start living? When are we going to start connecting to people around us? When are we going to just have fun? I can't have fun. It's darkness everywhere. Death. Yeah, man, if you surround yourself with that constantly and that's all you're feeding yourself all day is negativity, and that's all these conspiracies, most conspiracy podcasts are now. It's just feeding fear, feeding the worst types of behavior. And if you're feeding yourself that all day long, especially if you're not grounded at all or have any kind of relationship with God, you're going to tail out and you're going to think that everything is evil and bad. Far from it. Far from it, in my opinion, that everything is evil and bad. And I am sick and tired of that contingent of Christian conspiracy theorists who are just constantly talking about evil. Constantly. Oh, and they'll give you excuses why they do it too. I have to. I gotta wake them up. It's not your job to wake anybody up. It's your job to spread love and compassion. That just automatically wakes people up. And what is waking people up, right? Waking them up to what? Your truth? Because I can tell you right now, conspiracy theories are very convoluted. You may think you have the real truth and you could be way off base, just like I could be. That's not waking people up. Waking people up is sharing the love and compassion that Christ gave us. That's it. That's it. None of the rest matters. That's why I created this show. I got so exhausted and sick and tired of all these other conspiratorial podcasts out there. They're not all bad. There's some great ones out there that do very similar things that I do, speaking positivity and love and compassion. But I'd say the majority don't. And fear sells. It does. The nastier, darker stuff you talk about, the more people are like, ooh, yeah. It's like Gollum in Lord of the Rings. My precious. So back to the midrash, because we're going to get into, I know y'all probably ready to cut me off today. Joel's off his rocker. Give him his meds. So we're going to get back to the midrash because I want to talk about how that the midrash does talk about four brothers. So I don't want to throw that out. Like, if you believe in the four brothers theory with the five stones, there's a basis for it. So I don't want to say that that's not the case, but I also want to look at even deeper meaning for the five stones that have to do with the Holy Spirit and have to do with God. So to the midrash, Goliath was of ignoble birth. He's not of noble birth. His mother is said to have been Orpah, who, after making a pretense of accompanying Ruth, her mother-in-law, and walking with her 40 paces, had left her and had led a very profligate, which means reckless, extravagant, or wasteful in the use of resources, life, so that Goliath, her son, was of uncertain paternity. So because of her profligate, her very extravagant or promiscuous lifestyle that she had, no one knew who the father was of Goliath. And I've got some ideas what it could be. So if we don't know who the father was, no idea, not even in the midrash where they're really digging deep, it could have been a fallen angel. It could have been Dagon himself, or it could have been another Nephilim, which is highly possible too. And she was definitely in a hotbed of Nephilim. So that's also possible. So where we get the other brothers, right? And again, this isn't even indicative of all the brothers, because in the Midrash, it says she bore beside Goliath three other giants. And this is in the Midrash Tanchuma Buber Vayagash, 8. So we're still at 4. We're not at 5 total. So we still don't have anything specific scripturally or even in the Midrash where it lays out 5 total. We've got 4 counting Goliath in the Midrash. That still leaves us one without. If we go to the Bible and we look at what I showed, that we have to use circumstantial evidence to say, okay, well, they're naming 4 other giants or alluding to 4 other giants, so they had to be Goliath's brothers. Maybe, you know, we don't have anything specific that tells us that. And I want people to be very clear with that. When people tell you, oh, he had 4 brothers, we don't know that. Not for a fact. We can use circumstantial evidence and say that maybe we thought he did. And I'm okay with people thinking he did. He may very well had. But we don't know for sure. And even to the Midrash, this is the exegesis of the text. It only says that she bore 3 other giants beside Goliath. So that'd be 4 total. Oh, he's still got an extra stone, right? If we're going by the stone theory. But again, I read the verses in the Bible that name off 4 other placements of giants, because one of them didn't even have a name. And that's where we get this idea that, oh, well, they came from the same source. I don't know, maybe. But we don't have anything definitive. So when someone tells you that, just say, hey, you know what? Maybe you're right. But there's nothing definitive scripturally or even extra canonically that shows us that he has 4 brothers. So what do the 5 stones mean? Because again, there are people that have to believe he had 4 brothers because they say, whoa, well, why would he get extra stones? He didn't trust God with the 1 stone? Not at all. God told him to get 5 stones. So 5 smooth stones from the brook or river that he got. So before we get into these 5 stones, let's look at the Hebrew word used here for brook. It's different than the word for river used in Genesis 2:10, which talks about the rivers of Eden. In Hebrew, the word is Nachal, spelled Nun, Chet, Lamed. It is indeed a stream, brook, or river, but what it means in the verbal root, also Nachal, it means to inherit, to occupy, to bequeath, or to possess. So in other words, David drew his ammo from the only trustworthy source, from the living waters of the promises of Yahweh. David knew that Saul's armor had not been tested, which we just talked about, had not been proved. He was not going to rock it. But there was one that had never failed David in the past. And so David took the inheritance from the living waters. This was a representation of the living waters that he took these stones from. Why 5? This is what we need to get into. Why 5? So in Hebrew, a stone or ebon, and I'm going to get into ebon stones here in a minute. We're going to get into the craziness with the stones. It's a contraction of the words father and son, av ben. This is in Hebrew. This is why a stone is not only strong, but a far worthier choice of ammo against the enemy. What is stronger than the father and the son? Ho, 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 ho. Father and the son. Nothing. If this is true, why did David choose 5 stones when it only took 1 stone to defeat the giant? Well, 5 is the number of strength and power as the 5th manifestation of the Holy Spirit. And this is, you can find this in Isaiah 11:2, and they talk about different parts of the Holy Spirit: counsel, knowledge, fear, strength, understanding, wisdom. But that's where they get this idea from, this 5th manifestation, which is strength. Now, this power is what fueled the first global migrations of the birds and fish created on the 5th day of creation. So just in case you miss this connection with creation and the number 5, it says in 1 Samuel 17:48 that when Goliath went to meet David in battle, that David ran quickly to meet him. The word for ran is rutz. In Hebrew, R-U-T-Z is the same root word used to describe the movement of the creatures created on day 5. Quick flowing movement is a trademark of those filled with Yahweh's spirit power. So we're back to 5 again. So if we look at more significances of the number 5, we consider there are 5 books of Moses or the Torah. The Ten Commandments are written on two stone tablets with five commandments teaching on how to love Yahweh and five teaching on how to love their neighbor. Five is also associated with grace, the gospel, and anointing. So though it only took one stone to defeat Goliath, David picked up five, and that is a clear indication that the word is what defeats a beast. And David, he overcame Goliath with one stone by quoting one of the five books of the Torah. Guess what book it was? Deuteronomy, the fifth book. It's not a coincidence. So there's a reason for five being used. And I would say at the root core of it, five is associated with grace, the gospel, and anointing. And that's why he picked up five. I don't think it was because of the four supposed other brothers. Again, we don't know. The Midrash is saying he only had three brothers. We know in the Bible of four other giants. We have nothing definitive outside of one being said that they were Goliath's brother. So what's the significance of the five stones? I think that's the significance. I think it's a deeper meaning behind the five stones, not because he had four other brothers or supposed other brothers. So back to verse 40. And he took his staff in his hand and chose him five smooth stones out of a brook and put them in a shepherd's bag, which he had even in a scrip, and his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. Just read this verse, but I wanted to read it again so we can get zoned back in. So stone in this verse in Hebrew is abanim, only means stone. Remember that. And the Philistine came on and drew near unto David, and the man that bare the shield went before him. And when the Philistine, this is Goliath, looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy and of fair countenance. So he's looking at this little skinny twig, and he's laughing. And he even says unto David, am I a dog that you comest to me with staves or sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his God. So I'm sure he was calling out upon his fathers or grandfathers, Dagon, cursing David. And David said to the Philistine, thou comest to me with the sword and with the spear and with the shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. And it came to pass when the Philistine arose and came and drew nigh to meet David, that David hasted and ran toward the enemy to meet the Philistine. So he's running. Hebrew word ruts. He's flying to him, probably imbued with the Holy Spirit, flying. And David put his hand in his bag and took thence a stone and slung it. Smote the Philistine in his forehead, and the stone sunk into his forehead, and he fell upon his face to the earth. Now, two things here. One, we know that the stone hit him in the forehead, and it sunk into his head. So, what's the significance of that? Well, if we want to suggest that Goliath was a Nephilim, and he had what we would consider now superpowers, and it said that Nephilim had the ability to use psionic weapons. They could use their third eye to disrupt people in battle, where they would feel like they were slogging through mud or quicksand or mess with their minds, right? That would be significant for him to take that out and sling it right at his forehead. And the fact that it sunk into his forehead to take out his pineal gland would make a lot of sense. The second thing is the word stone. So now, it's not abanim anymore. It's ebon. Now, the meaning of ebon in some cases is singularly stone, but the first occurrence is in Genesis 2:12 and refers to as a precious stones. And as we dig deeper into the different meanings of ebon, it's long. When I was looking through my Hebrew dictionary, it was like a whole page of different meanings of ebon and all the different variations of ebon throughout the Bible. Our English word sapphire is also a derivative from the word ebon, and also meaning consecrated, that the stone was consecrated. It goes even deeper. If we go to Ezekiel 28:14-16, it speaks of the ebon stones or fire stones. This is easily translated, probably refers to the stone which sparkles. Even today, diamonds are frequently described as fiery, but these are the fire stones. Go to Ezekiel 28:14-16. You were anointed as a guardian cherub, talking about Lucifer, for I had ordained you. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked among the fire stones. Number 16, by the vastness of your trade, this is old Earth, and I've talked about this plenty of times, where he was trading with civilizations before Adam. You were filled with violence and you sinned, so I drove you in disgrace from the mountain of God, and I banished you, old guardian cherub, from among the fiery stones. So we have to look at what were these fire stones. Well, one, I think we got to look at the allegorical context too. When we're looking at Psalm 118:22, the stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. So the stone there's Eben, consecrated stone, fire stone, and the builders rejected it, which is the cornerstone, which this was a representation of Jesus coming, which was the Jews rejecting, some Jews, not all, but some Jews rejected Jesus as being the Messiah when he came, and he was the chief cornerstone. And this is, I'm bringing up the cornerstones. We'll jump to Isaiah 28:16 as well. Therefore, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I'm laying in Zion a stone, a tested stone, costly cornerstone for the foundation firmly placed. He believes and it will not be disturbed. Again, alluding to Jesus, talking about Jesus. Well, what is this significance? The philosopher's stone. This is where alchemy comes into place here. This is where the idea of what happened with that stone when it left that sling. So for people that don't know, we'll just give brief descriptions of what the philosopher's stone is. We can go so many different ways with that on other episodes. So the philosopher's stone is a mythic alchemical substance capable of turning base metals such as mercury into gold or silver. It's also known as the tincture and the powder. Alchemists additionally believe that it could be used to make an elixir of life, which made possible rejuvenation and immortality. And efforts to discover the philosopher's stone were known as the magnum opus or great work. And there's so many different variations of what people think the philosopher's stone is. But at the essence is some sort of transmutation, right? Whether you're transmuting yourself into the next realm, like some of these alchemists thought they were doing, or transmuting something here on Earth. So many different variations. And like I've said a million times on this show, when it comes to alchemy, I know there would be a contingent of Christians who would balk at the idea of talking about alchemy when it comes to the Bible. I'm not one of those. I think that alchemy in and of itself isn't evil. I think the twisting of what these Gnostics and most of these alchemists did with it was a twisted version of what the fallen entities gave them and showed them that they could essentially transmute things here on Earth or transmute themselves to become gods, right? So again, I don't think that the process is inherently evil, because I think that when you look at Adam, when you look at Moses, when you look at some of these great patriarchs throughout the Bible, they were able to do fantastic things, things that we would consider alchemy, right? So again, I'm not one of those in the camp that's like, it's alchemy, it's bad. I'd say, yeah, when we're talking about these famous alchemists throughout history, for the most part, I think they've been deceived. But again, I don't think that you can just lump this big umbrella of alchemy and say it's all evil, right? Now, the earliest known mention of the Philosopher's Stone was in the Kerak Meta, which was written by Zosimos of Panopolis in 300 AD. And Zosimos of Panopolis, also known by the Latin name Zosimus Alchemista, was an alchemist and Gnostic mystic. There we go. It's all, you know, Gnostics. Gnosticism always shows up when we're talking about alchemy and, you know, transmuting yourself to become greater than the gods. And he was born in Panopolis, and he wrote the oldest known books on alchemy and the Kerak Meta, which is the Greek word for things made by hand. Now, I'm going to read a couple sections from the Kerak Meta, and this is the translated to English from what Zosimos himself said. And he said that knowledge is treated with great honor because only a philosopher who has acquired wisdom scientifically and practically is able to use it. An experimentalist may obey his master when he tells him, take this and do such and such a thing, evaporate, dissolve it, distill it, and so on until the end of the work. That aid does not understand anything beyond how to do things, whereas the person who comprehends the science and the practice knows how and why something is evaporated. i.e. the purpose of the evaporation. This is why, to become a philosopher, one must know the aim of wisdom in each step of the work. He's not wrong on some of that, because I agree, being told what to think, being told what to do, and doing it is different than actually learning the process. So again, there's that fine line, right, between knowledge and then twisting that knowledge to try to become a god. Now, the book also contains several quotes made by famous Greek philosophers such as Aristotle, whose discussions with Plato are reproduced in some detail, and Democritus, who is quoted as saying, "The stone is not formed until it has gathered all the colors that exist in the universe and until it has been colored with all the simple and complex colors." So they do refer to it as an actual stone. Again, so many different variations what people think the philosopher's stone is, and it could be all of them. But we're just getting into an actual stone today, an actual transmutation of an actual stone today. Now, according to Plato, when it comes to the philosopher's stone, the four elements are derived from a common source called the prima materia, or first matter, associated with chaos. And in alchemy and philosophy, the prima materia is the starting material required for the alchemical magnum opus, and the creation of the philosopher's stone is the primitive formless base of all matter similar to chaos, quintessential or aether. And you can connect that even to the Azoth, which the Azoth was a universal remedy or potent solvent sought after in the realm of alchemy, akin to the alkahest. And it's very similar to this prima materia in that it's an esoteric formula, and it's able to transmute things to mercury. Sometimes it's actually used as mercury, but it's the same thing. It's that prima materia. And this is what you pull from, this beginning matter. This is like the start of everything, the beginning matter. And pulling from God himself, the monad, if we're going to go the Gnostic route, which all this typically goes that route, to create. Now, I don't think that's off when we look at what God or Yahweh does when he, with his power, transmutes things. And we know through all throughout the Bible of things being transmuted, things being created, changed. We know of Yeshua himself taking the loaves and fish and making an immense amount of it just from very little. That's just one story. There's tons of stories, just stuff that Jesus has done outside of the fact the Old Testament, even in the New Testament, everybody was doing stuff with the power of God. And you want to say that's some sort of prima materia or the power of God, then sure. Again, I don't think that the Gnostics and the alchemists are all the way wrong. I just think they have a twisted viewpoint of what's really going on. Now, to tie it into the stones and the cornerstone, because I think everything has an allegory to it, even if it's a real story, right? I think this story of David and Goliath will link to the coming of Christ. I think everything was always mapped to be the coming of Christ. Even the transmutation of this stone that I'm suggesting happened when he fought Goliath. Now, I want to go to 1 Peter 2:7-8. This precious value then is for you to who believe, but for those who disbelieve, the stone which the builders rejected thus became the very cornerstone and the stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. For they stumble because they are disobedient to the world, and to this doom they were also appointed. If we look at stone, which in the Koine Greek is lithos, if we look at it as the synonym petros, the stone is a substance. This gets into the stone itself being a substance. This goes back to this idea of the philosopher's stone. Some people think it's a substance. Some people think it's the substance is the transmutation part of it. The prima materia is considered a substance. So if we're looking at it from that aspect, and we're looking at the allegory of Jesus coming, we're looking at the New Testament to correlate to the Old Testament, there's a perfect example. And if you want to know if Jesus is actually the cornerstone, Ephesians 2:20-22, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the cornerstone, in whom the whole building being fitted together is growing into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are being built together into a dwelling of God in the Spirit. So Jesus Christ himself being the cornerstone. So we know that he's the cornerstone from the Old Testament and the New. Now, descriptions of the philosopher's stone are numerous and various, But in most alchemical texts, they came in two varieties, prepared by almost an identical method, white being for the purpose of making silver and red for the purpose of making gold, which is generally the one that they gravitate to the most. And I found that fascinating. If we're talking about fire stones and red stones, here is the red philosopher's stone that creates gold, which is one of the most precious metals that people use for all kinds of things, but it's specifically for monetary value. And the weight of it is spoken as being heavier than gold and is soluble in any liquid and incombustible in fire. So that goes back to the fire stones. This thing is incombustible in fire. So to break down all those different things, I'm going to get into what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting that when David took the Abinim stones from the brook, by the time he gets there to throw it at Goliath in the sling, when it leaves the sling, the word changes to Eben, the fire stones, when it leaves the sling. From all indications, there is a transmutation that happens. The stone is transmuted into this Eben stone, the fire stones, when it takes Goliath out. I believe that God, Yahweh, imbued the stone, transmuted the stone when it left David's sling, became the Eben stone, and then hit Goliath's forehead, went through his forehead, took out his pineal gland, took out his psionic weapon, if we want to go there, and killed Goliath. Now, there's more to this story, more magical weaponry to this story. If that's not crazy enough, the idea that David's stones transmuted into a philosopher's stone for people in the alchemical world to understand, this Eben stone, this fire stone. Let's talk about Goliath's sword. Verse 51, therefore David ran and stood upon the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of the sheath thereof and slew him and cut off his head therewith. And when the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they fled. So the Hebrew word for sword there is Hereb, H-E-R-E-B, and it's tied into a description of the sword of Yahweh used as an instrument of his judgment. So you'll see this pop up a lot with this word Hereb. Also, it ties into the flaming swords in the hands of the cherubim who guarded Eden and is also an objectification of lightning. So if we want to suggest that Goliath's sword was not only just a normal sword, but was like the rest of his armor, some sort of technology, then we would have to suggest that this Hereb that David ran to pick up to chop Goliath's head off had some sort of what we would say magical powers too. And we say, well, okay, you've got some descriptors of the word Hereb, and it does tie into the flaming swords of the cherubim, ties into the sword of Yahweh. What else do you have that could show that? Well, I've got several other things scripturally and in the Midrash that talk about what that sword represented. So one, let's think about this. That is a giant's sword, a Nephilim sword. How did scrawny David run over there and pick up the sword and decapitate Goliath? How did he do it? How did he pick that sword up? Now, we could say that God gave him the power, right? But there's nothing in the verse that says that. But we could say that, and not totally. If you tell me I don't like anything you're saying today, it was all God, cool. I'm saying the same thing. I'm just giving a deeper way that that could work. But if you're just saying it's like that cut and dry, it could be. Maybe it is, but there's so much when it comes to exegesis of the text throughout the last couple thousand years that show that there's more going on here in the story. So according to the Midrash, Goliath Jelinek, Goliath's sword had magical powers. It was believed that it was able to change size and weight to match the owner. So David turns down this Nephilim armor from Saul. It fit him to his size, but he let it go. But then he goes and picks up Goliath's sword, and then it just magically fits to him. Unless we think like all this stuff's kind of coming from the same place, right? If it's kind of doing the same thing, fitting the owner, fitting the person that wears it, fitting the person that holds it. So you may say, okay, I see where you're going. The Midrash is talking about it has miraculous powers. It can fit the owner's hand. It can fit the size of the owner. But, you know, is there anything biblically that would suggest that this sword was something spectacular? Well, there's two verses. One, I want to go back to a verse I read to you earlier, 2 Samuel 21, 16, and Ishbi-Benob, which was the sons of the giant, one that suggested to possibly be one of Goliath's brothers, the weight of whose spear weighed 300 shekels of brass in weight, he being girded with a new sword, thought to have slain David. Well, sword, there's no meaning for that word in the Hebrew. We don't know what it means. We have no translation for it. New is hadesay, a new, but that word, nobody knows what it means. They just supplemented sword in there. They just supplemented whatever they supplement, depending on the translation. Nobody knows what it means. It's a piece of technology. It's some sort of weaponry that is so far out there that we don't even know how to say it. So there's our first suggestion that, okay, biblically, we know that these Nephilim giants had some sort of technology that we don't understand. So how do we get to Goliath's sword being magical in the Bible? Well, this happens a little later. If it's not crazy enough that scrawny David picked up this giant sword and chopped off his head, we went to the Midrash. We showed that through the exegesis of the text, it said that the sword had miraculous powers and it changed to the size of the owner. But we're going to get biblical. So David's fleeing from King Saul, who's trying to kill him, right? There's a large contingent of Israelites that are ready for David to be king. Saul's still fighting it tooth and nail, this Nephilim king, and he's hunting David down. So David goes to the town of Nob, where he visits with a priest named Ahimelech. David told him that he was on an urgent mission from the king and needed bread and a weapon, so he lies to him. The priest told him, "The sword of Goliath, the Philistine, whom you killed in the Valley of Elah, is here, wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod." And if you don't know what the ephod is, it's a type of apron that was worn by high priests of Israel. And you'll see it when you see pictures of priests in the temples from ancient times. You'll see those aprons that they have on. That's what an ephod is. And he says, "Wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod, if you want to take it for yourself, then take it. It's better." 1 Samuel 21:9. "And David said, there is none like that. Give it to me." So, and I'm going to read it in the Berean too. "For there is no other but this one. And David said, there is none like it. Give it to me." So he is stating biblically that this sword, there's nothing like it on the planet. That this sword that he used to chop Goliath's head off, this magical sword, this alchemical sword that changes to fit the wearer. They had it hidden in a temple. Ahimelech and all the other priests hid it in a temple, guarded it in this temple. They let David take it because David's the one that used it to chop Goliath's head off, but he went and got it. He wanted that specific sword. He could have went and got a sword anywhere else. He could have done anything. But this correlates all the way back to King Saul being a Nephilim too. David went and got the Nephilim sword of Goliath to combat who? Another Nephilim, the King Nephilim of Israel. This is a piece of technology. But that's biblical that this sword, there's none like it. Nothing like it. And I believe that denotes that the sword had powers and it was no ordinary sword. Guys, I hope you enjoyed this episode today. I love talking about the strange biblical world, and I had a blast doing it. Guys, if you can, if you enjoyed this episode, and I say this all the time, please go give a 5-star review. Please go write a review where you can, specifically on Apple Podcasts. Give a 5-star review on Spotify. It helps the show grow. I've heard other podcasters say on their show too that, man, I've got all these listeners, why aren't people taking 30 seconds out of their day, just a minute out of their day to go give a 5-star review or go write a review? I get everybody's busy, But this helps the show grow. It helps get out there to more people. So if you enjoy the show and you want other people to listen to it, help the show grow. I really appreciate all the people that have already done it. If you haven't, please go do it. And on the way out, we're going to listen to Head in the Clouds. And you know what it is, guys. Go outside, touch grass, and get your tail out the hole.
I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps, in line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic.
Keep your eyes on the road.
Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Yeah. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. Yeah. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps, in line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic.
Keep your eyes on the road.
Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Yeah. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. Yeah. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.